I said sick, not stick, but I guess it'll do, Stu told him. He sent Kojak out for a dozen more sticks. Soon he had a fire blazing. Even sitting close would not drive the shivers away, although sweat was rolling down his face. It was the final irony. He had the flu, or something very like it. He had come down with it 2 days after Glenn, Larry, and Ralph left him. For another 2 days, the flu had seemed to consider him. Was he worth taking? Apparently he was. Little by little, he was getting worse. And this morning, he felt very bad indeed. Among the odds and ends in his pockets, Stu found a stub of pencil, his notebook, all the Free Zone organizational stuff that had once seemed the vital stuff of life itself, now seemed mildly foolish, and his key ring. He had puzzled over the key ring for a long time, coming back to it over the last few days again and again, constantly surprised by the strong ache of sadness and nostalgia. This one was to his apartment. This one was his locker key. This one was a spare for his car, a 1977 Dodge with a lot of rust. So far as he knew, it was still parked behind the apartment building at 31 Thompson Street in Arnett. Also attached to the keyring was a cardboard address card encased in lucite. Stu Redman, 31 Thompson Street. Phone 713-555-6283, it read. He took the keys off the ring, bounced them thoughtfully on the palm of his hand for a moment, and then threw them away. The last of the man he had been went into the dry wash and clinked into a dry clump of sage, where it would stay, he supposed, until the end of time. He slipped the cardboard address card out of the lucite and then ripped a blank page from his notebook. "Dear Franny," he wrote at the top. He told her all that had happened up until he had broken his leg. He told her that he hoped to see her again, but that he doubted it was in the cards. The best he could hope for was that Kojak would find the zone again. He wiped tears absently from his face with the heel of his hand and wrote that he loved her. "I expect you to mourn me and then get on," he wrote. "You and the baby have to get on. That's the most important thing now." He signed, folded it small, and slipped the note into the address slot in the lucite square. Then he attached the key ring to Kojak's collar. "Good dog," he said when that was done. "You want to go look around? Find a rabbit or something?" Kojak bounded up the slope where Stu had broken his leg and was gone. Stu watched his progress with a mixture of bitterness and amusement, then picked up the 7-Up can Kojak had brought him on one trip yesterday in lieu of a stick. He had filled it with muddy water from the ditch. When the water stood, the mud silted down to the bottom. It made a gritty drink, but as his mother would have said, it was a whole lot grittier when there was none. He drank slowly, slaking his thirst bit by bit. It hurt to swallow. "Life sure is a bitch," he muttered. And then had to laugh at himself. For a moment or two, he let his fingers fret at the swellings high on his neck, just under his jaw. Then he lay back, splinted leg in front of him, and dozed. He woke with a start about an hour later, clutching at the sandy earth in sleepy panic. Had he had a nightmare? If so, it seemed to still be going on. The ground was moving slowly under his hands. "Earthquake? We got an earthquake here?" For a moment he clung to the idea that it must be delirium, that his fever had come back while he dozed. But looking toward the gully, he saw the dirt was sliding down in small muddy sheets. Bounding, bouncing pebbles flashed mica and quartz glints at his startled eyes. And then a faint, dull thudding noise came. It seemed to push its way into his ears. A moment later he was heaving for breath, as if most of the air had suddenly been pushed out of the gully the flash flood had cut. There was a whining sound above him. Kojak stood silhouetted against the western edge of the cut, hunkered down with his tail between his legs. He was staring west, toward Nevada. "Kojak!" Stu cried in panic. That thudding noise had terrified him, It was as if God had suddenly stamped his foot down on the desert floor somewhere not too distant. Kojak bounded down the slope and joined him, whining. As Stu passed a hand down the dog's back, he felt Kojak trembling. He had to see. He had to. A sudden feeling of surety came to him. What had been meant to happen was happening. Right now. "I'm going up, boy," Stu muttered. He crawled to the eastern edge of the gully. It was a little steeper, but it offered more handholds. He had thought for the last 3 days that he might be able to get up there, but he hadn't seen the point. He was sheltered from the worst of the wind at the bottom of the cut, and he had water. But now he had to get up there. He had to see. He dragged his splinted leg behind him like a club. He got up on his hands and craned his neck to see the top. It looked very high, very far away. "Can't do it, boy," he muttered to Kojak, and started trying anyway. A fresh pile of rubble had piled up at the bottom as a result of the earthquake, or whatever it was. Stu pulled himself over it and then began to inch his way up the slope, using his hands and his left knee. He made 12 yards and then lost 6 of them before he could grab a quartz outcropping and stop his slide. "Nope, never make it," he panted, and rested. 10 minutes later, he started again and made another 10 yards. He rested, went again, came to a place with no holds and had to inch to the left until he found one. Kojak walked beside him, no doubt wondering what this fool was up to, leaving his water and his nice warm fire. Warm. Too warm. The fever must be coming up again, but at least the shivering had subsided. Fresh sweat was running down his face and arms. His hair, dusty and oily, hung in his eyes. "Lord, I'm burning up. Must be 102, 103. He happened to glance at Kojak. It took almost a minute for what he was seeing to sink in. Kojak was panting. It wasn't fever, or not just fever, because Kojak was hot too. Overhead, a squadron of birds suddenly flocked, wheeling aimlessly and squawking. "They feel it, too. Whatever it is, the birds feel it, too." He began to crawl again, fear lending him additional strength. An hour passed, 2. He fought for every foot, every inch. By 1 o'clock that afternoon, he was only 6 feet below the edge. He could see jags of pavement jutting out above him. Only 6 feet, but the grade here was very steep and smooth. He tried once to just wriggle up like a garter snake, but loose gravel, the underbedding of the interstate, had begun to rattle out from beneath him, and now he was afraid that if he tried to move at all, he would go all the way to the bottom again, probably breaking his other damn leg in the process. "Stuck," he muttered. "Good fucking show. Now what?" Now what became obvious very quickly. Even without moving around, the earth was beginning to shift downward beneath him. He slipped an inch and clawed for purchase with his hands. His broken leg was thudding heavily, and he had not thought to pocket Glenn's pills. He slipped another 2 inches, then 5. His left foot was now dangling over space. Only his hands were holding him, and as he watched, they began to slip, digging 10 little furrows in the damp ground. "Kojak!" he cried miserably, expecting nothing. But suddenly, Kojak was there. Stu flung his arms around his neck blindly, not expecting to be saved, but only grabbing what there was to be grabbed, like a drowning man. Kojak made no effort to throw him off. He dug in. For a moment they were frozen, a living sculpture. Then Kojak began to move, digging for inches, claws clicking against small stones and bits of gravel. Pebbles rattled into Stu's face and he shut his eyes. Kojak dragged him, panting, like an air compressor in Stu's right ear. He slitted his eyes open and saw they were nearly at the top. Kojak's head was down. His back legs were working furiously. He gained 4 more inches, and it was enough. With a desperate cry, Stu let go of Kojak's neck and grabbed an outcrop of paving. It snapped off in his hands. He grabbed another one. 2 fingernails peeled back like wet decals, and he cried out. The pain was exquisite, galvanizing. He scrambled up, pistoning with his good leg, and at last, somehow, lay panting on the surface of I-70, his eyes shut. Kojak was beside him then. He whined and licked Stu's face. Slowly then, Stu sat up and looked west. He looked for a long time, oblivious of the heat that was still rushing against his face in warm, bloated waves.
"Oh, my God," he said at last in a weak, breaking voice. "Look at that, Kojak. Larry, Glenn, they're gone. God, everything's gone. All gone."
The mushroom cloud stood out on the horizon like a clenched fist on the end of a long, dusty forearm. It was swirling, fuzzy at the edges, beginning to dissipate. It was backlighted in sullen orange-red, as if the sun had decided to go down in the early afternoon.
"The firestorm," he thought.
They were all dead in Las Vegas. Someone had fiddled when he should have faddled, and a nuclear weapon had gone off. And one hellish big one from the look and the feel. Maybe a whole stockpile of them had gone. Glenn, Larry, Ralph. Even if they hadn't reached Vegas yet, even if they were still walking, surely they were close enough to have been baked alive. Close beside him, Kojak whimpered unhappily.
"Fallout. Which way is the wind going to blow?"
Did it matter? He remembered his note to Fran. It was important that he add what had happened. If the wind blew the fallout east, it might cause them problems. But more than that, they had to know that if Las Vegas had been the Dark Man's staging area, it was gone now. The people had been vaporized along with all the deadly toys that had just been lying around, waiting for someone to pick them up. He ought to add all of that to the note. But not now. He was too tired now. The climb had exhausted him, and the stupendous sight of that dissipating mushroom cloud had exhausted him even more. He felt no jubilation, only dull and grinding weariness. He lay down on the pavement, and his last thought before drifting off to sleep was, "How many megatons?" He didn't think anyone would ever know, or want to know. He awoke after 6. The mushroom cloud was gone, but the western sky was an angry pinkish red, like a bright wheel of burn flesh. Stu hauled himself over to the breakdown lane and lay down, exhausted all over again. The shakes were back, and the fever. He touched his forehead with his wrist and tried to gauge the temperature there. He guessed it was well over 100 degrees. Kojak came out of the early evening with a rabbit in his jaws. He laid it at Stu's feet and wagged his tail, waiting to be complimented.
"Good dog," Stu said tiredly. "That's a good dog."
Kojak's tail wagged faster.
"Yes, I'm a pretty good dog,"
he seemed to agree. But he remained looking at Stu, seeming to wait for something. Part of the ritual was incomplete. Stu tried to think what it was. His brain was moving very slowly. While he was sleeping, someone seemed to have poured molasses all over his interior gears.
"Good dog," he repeated, and looked at the dead rabbit.
Then he remembered, although he wasn't even sure he had his matches anymore.
"Fetch Kojak," he said, mostly to please the dog.
Kojak bounced away and soon returned with a good chunk of dry wood. He had his matches, but a good breeze had sprung up and his hands were shaking badly. It took a long time to get a fire going. He got the kindling he had stripped, lighted on the 10th match, and then the breeze gusted roguishly, puffing out the flames. Stu rebuilt it carefully, shielding it with his body and his hands. He had 8 remaining matches in a LaSalle Business School folder. He cooked the rabbit, gave Kojak his half, and could eat only a little of his share. He tossed Kojak what was left. Kojak didn't pick it up. He looked at it, then whined uneasily at Stu.
"Go on, boy, I can't."
Kojak ate up. Stu looked at him and shivered. His 2 blankets were, of course, below. The sun went down, and the western sky was grotesque with color. It was the most spectacular sunset Stu had ever seen in his life.
and it was poison. He could remember the narrator of a movie-tone newsreel saying enthusiastically back in the early 60s that there were beautiful sunsets for weeks after a nuclear test. And, of course, after earthquakes. Kojak came up from the washout with something in his mouth, one of Stu's blankets. He dropped it in Stu's lap.
"Hey," Stu said, hugging him unsteadily. "You're some kind of dog, you know it."
Kojak wagged his tail to show that he knew it. Stu wrapped the blanket around him and moved closer to the fire. Kojak lay next to him, and soon they both slept. But Stu's sleep was light and uneasy, skimming in and out of delirium. Sometime after midnight he roused Kojak, yelling in his sleep.
"Hap!" Stu cried. "You better turn off your pumps. He's coming. Black man's coming for you. Better turn off your pumps. He's in the old car yonder."
Kojak whined uneasily. The man was sick. He could smell the sickness, and mingling with that smell was a new one. A black one. It was the smell the rabbits had on them when he pounced. The smell had been on the wolf he had disemboweled under Mother Abigail's house in Hemingford Home. The smell had been on the towns he had passed through on his way to Boulder and Glen Bateman. It was the smell of death. If he could have attacked it and driven it out of this man, he would have. But it was inside this man. The man drew in good air and sent out that smell of coming death, and there was nothing to do but wait and see it through to the end. Kojak whined again, low, and then slept. Stu woke up the next morning more feverish than ever. The glands under his jaw had swollen to the size of golf balls. His eyes were hot marbles.
"I'm dying. Yes, that's affirmative."
He called Kojak over and removed the keychain and his note from the Lucite address holder. Printing carefully, he added what he had seen and replaced the note. He lay back down and slept. And then, somehow, it was nearly dark again. Another spectacular, horrible sunset burned and jittered in the west, and Kojak had brought a gopher for dinner.
"This the best you could do?"
Kojak wagged his tail and grinned shamefacedly. Stu cooked it, divided it, and managed to eat his entire half. It was tough, and it had a horrible wild taste, and when he was done he had a nasty bout of stomach cramps.
"When I die, I want you to go back to Boulder," he told the dog. "You go back and find Fran. Find Franny. Okay, you big old dumb dog?"
Kojak wagged his tail doubtfully. An hour later, Stu's stomach rumbled once in warning. He had just enough time to roll over on one elbow to avoid fouling himself before his share of the gopher came up in a rush.
"Shit," he muttered miserably, and dozed off.
He awoke in the small hours and got up on his elbows, his head buzzing with fever. The fire had gone out, he saw. It didn't matter. He was pretty well done up. Some sound in the darkness had awakened him. Pebbles and stones. Kojak coming up the embankment from the cut, that's all it was. Except that Kojak was beside him, sleeping. Even as Stu glanced at him, the dog woke up. His head came off his paws, and a moment later he was on his feet, facing the cut, growling deep in his throat. Rattling pebbles and stones. Someone, something, coming up. Stu struggled into a sitting position.
"It's him," he thought. "He was there, but somehow he got away. Now he's here and he means to do me before the flu can."
Kojak's growl became stronger. His hackles stood. His head was down. The rattling sound was closer now. Stu could hear a low panting sound. There was a pause then, long enough for Stu to arm sweat off his forehead. A moment later, a dark shape humped against the edge of the cut, head and shoulders blotting out the stars. Kojak advanced, stiff-legged, still growling.
"Hey!"
a bewildered but familiar voice said.
Hey, is that Kojak? Is it?
The growling stopped immediately. Kojak bounded forward joyfully, tail wagging.
No, Stu croaked. It's a trick. Kojak!
But Kojak was jumping up and down on the figure that had finally gained the pavement. And that shape. Something about the shape was also familiar. It advanced toward him with Kojak at his heel. Kojak was volleying joyful barks. Stu licked his lips and got ready to fight if he had to. He thought he could manage one good punch, maybe two.
"Who is it?" he called.
"Who is that there?"
The dark figure paused, then spoke.
"Well, it's Tom Cullen, that's who, my laws, yes. M-O-O-N, that spells Tom Cullen. Who's that?"
"Stu," he said,
and his voice seemed to come from far away. Everything was far away now.
"Hello, Tom. It's good to see you."
But he didn't see him. Not that night. Stu fainted. He came around at 10 a.m. on October 2nd, although neither he nor Tom knew that was the date. Tom had built a huge bonfire and had wrapped Stu in his sleeping bag and his blankets. Tom himself was sitting by the fire and roasting a rabbit. Kojak lay contentedly on the ground between the two of them.
"Tom," Stu managed.
Tom came over. He had grown a beard, Stu saw. He hardly looked like the man who had left Boulder for the West 5 weeks ago. His blue eyes glinted happily.
"Stu Redman, you're awake now, my laws, yes. I'm glad. Boy, it's good to see you. What did you do to your leg? Hurt it, I guess. I hurt mine once, jumped off a haystack and broke it, I guess. Did my daddy whip me? My laws, yes. That was before he run off with Dee Dee Packalot.
Mine's broken, too, and how.
Tom, I'm awful thirsty. Oh, there's water, all kinds, here."
He handed Stu a plastic bottle that might once have held milk. The water was clear and delicious. No grit at all. Stu drank greedily and then threw it all up.
"Slow and easy does it," Tom said. "That's the ticket, slow and easy. Boy, it's good to see you. Hurt your leg, didn't you?"
"Yes, I broke it, a week ago, maybe longer."
He drank more water, and this time it stayed down.
"But there's more wrong than the leg. I'm bad sick, Tom. Fever. Listen to me."
"Right. Tom's listening. Just tell me what to do."
Tom leaned forward, and Stu thought,
"Why, he looks brighter. Is that possible?"
Where had Tom been? Did he know anything about the judge? About Dana? So many things to talk about, but there was no time now. He was getting worse. There was a deep rattling sound in his chest, like padded chains. Symptoms so much like the superflu. It was really quite funny.
"I've got to knock down the fever," he said to Tom. "That's the first thing. I need aspirin. Do you know aspirin?"
"Sure, aspirin, for fast, fast, fast relief."
"That's the ticket, all right. You start walking up the road, Tom. Look in the glove box of every car you come to. Look for a first aid kit. It'll most likely be a box with a red cross on it. When you find some aspirin in one of those boxes, bring it back here. And if you should find a car with camping gear in it, bring back a tent, okay?"
"Sure."
Tom stood up.
"Aspirin and a tent. Then you'll be all better again, right?"
"Well, it'll be a start."
"Say," Tom said, "how's Nick? I've been dreaming about him. In the dreams he tells me where to go, because in the dreams he can talk. Dreams are funny, aren't they? But when I try to talk to him, he always goes away. He's okay, isn't he?"
Tom looked at Stu anxiously.
"Not now," Stu said. I can't talk now. Not about that. Just get the aspirin, okay? Then we'll talk."
"Okay."
But fear had settled into Tom's face like a gray cloud.
"Kojak, wanna come with Tom?"
Kojak did. They walked off together, heading east. Stu lay down and put an arm over his eyes. When Stu slipped back into reality again, it was twilight. Tom was shaking him.
"Stu! Wake up, Stu!"
He was frightened by the way time seemed to be slipping by in sudden lurches, as if the teeth on the cog of his personal reality were wearing down. Tom had to help him sit up, and when he was sitting, he had to lean his head between his legs and cough. He coughed so long and hard that he almost passed out again. Tom watched him with alarm. Little by little, Stu got control of himself. He pulled the blankets closer around him. He was shivering again.
"What did you find, Tom?"
Tom held out a first aid kit. Inside were band-aids, mercurochrome, and a big bottle of Anacin. Stu was shocked to find he could not work the child-proof cap. He had to give it to Tom, who finally worried it open. Stu washed down 3 Anacin with water from the plastic bottle.
"And I found this," Tom said. "It was in a car full of camping stuff, but there was no tent."
It was a huge, puffy, double sleeping bag, fluorescent orange on the outside, the lining done in a gaudy stars and bars pattern.
"Yeah, that's great. Almost as good as a tent. You did fine, Tom."
"And these, they were in the same car." Tom reached into his jacket and produced 6 foil packages. Stu could hardly believe his eyes. Freeze-dried concentrates. Eggs, peas, squash, dried beef.
"Food, isn't it, Stu? It's got pictures of food on it, laws, yes."
"It's food," Stu agreed gratefully. "Just about the only kind I can eat, I think." His head was buzzing, and far away at the center of his brain, a sweetly sickening high C hummed on and on.
"Can we heat some water? We don't have a pot or a kettle."
"I'll find something."
"Yeah, fine."
"Stu?"
Stu looked into that troubled, miserable face, still a boy's face in spite of the beard, and slowly shook his head.
"Dead, Tom," he said gently. "Nick's dead. Almost a month ago. It was a political thing. Assassination, I suppose you'd say. I'm sorry."
Tom lowered his head, and in the freshly built-up fire, Stu saw his tears fall into his lap. They fell in a gentle silver rain, but he was silent. At last he looked up, his blue eyes brighter than ever. He wiped at them with the heel of his hand.
"I knew he was," he said huskily. "I didn't want to think I knew, but I did. Laws, yes. He kept turning his back and going away. He was my main man, Stu. Did you know that?"
Stu reached out and took Tom's big hand.
"I knew Tom. Yes, he was. M-O-O-N, that spells my main man. I miss him awful. But I'm going to see him in heaven. Tom Cullen will see him there. And he'll be able to talk, and I'll be able to think. Isn't that right?"
"It wouldn't surprise me at all, Tom."
"It was the bad man killed Nick. Tom knows. But God fixed that bad man. I saw it. The hand of God came down out of the sky."
There was a cold wind whistling over the floor of the Utah Badlands, and Stu shivered violently in its clasp.
"Fixed him for what he did to Nick and to the poor judge. Laws, yes."
"What do you know about the judge, Tom?"
"Dead. Up in Oregon. Shot him."
Stu nodded wearily.
"And Dana, do you know anything about her?"
"Tom saw her, but he doesn't know. They gave me a job cleaning up, and when I came back one day, I saw her doing her job. She was up in the air, changing a street light bulb. She looked at me, and—"
He fell silent for a moment, and when he spoke again, it was more to himself than to Stu.
"Did she see Tom? Did she know Tom? Tom doesn't know. Tom thinks she did. But Tom never saw her again."
Tom left to go foraging shortly after, taking Kojak with him, and Stu dozed. He returned not with a big tin can, which was the best Stu had hoped for, but with a broiling pan big enough to hold a Christmas turkey. There were treasures in the desert, apparently. Stu grinned in spite of the painful fever blisters that had begun to form on his lips. Tom told him he had gotten the pan from an orange truck with a big U on it. Someone who had been fleeing the superflu with all their worldly possessions, Stu guessed. Much good it had done them. Half an hour later, there was food. Stu ate carefully, sticking to the vegetables, watering the concentrates enough to make a thin gruel. He held everything down and felt a little better, at least for the time being. Not long after supper, he and Tom went to sleep, with Kojak between them.
Tom, listen to me.
Tom hunkered down by Stu's big, fluffy sleeping bag. It was the next morning. Stu had been able to eat only a little breakfast. His throat was sore and badly swollen, all his joints painful. The cough was worse, and the anacin wasn't doing much of a job knocking back the fever.
I gotta get inside and get some medicine into me or I'm gonna die, and it has to be today. Now, the closest town is Green River, and that's 60 miles east of here. We'll have to drive.
Tom Cullen can't drive a car, Stu. Laws, no.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be a chore for me, because as well as being sick as a dog, I broke the wrong friggin' leg.
What do you mean?
Well, never mind right now. It's too hard to explain. We won't even worry about it, because that ain't the first problem. The first problem is getting a car to start. Most of them have been sitting out here 3 months or more. The batteries will be as flat as pancakes, so we'll need a little luck. We've got to find a stalled car with a standard shift at the top of one of these hills. We might do it. It's pretty hilly country.
He didn't add that the car would have to have been kept reasonably tuned, would have to have some gas in it, and an ignition key. All those guys on TV might know how to hotwire a car, but Stu didn't have a clue. He looked up at the sky, which was scumming over with clouds.
Most of it's on you, Tom. You gotta be my legs.
All right, Stu. When we get the car, are we going back to Boulder? Tom wants to go to Boulder, don't you?
More than anything, Tom.
He looked toward the Rockies, which were a dim shadow on the horizon. Had the snow started falling up in the high passes yet? Almost certainly. And if not yet, then soon. Winter came early in this high and forsaken part of the world.
It may take a while, he said.
How do we start?
By making a travoy.
Stu gave Tom his pocket knife. You've got to make holes in the bottom of this sleeping bag, one on each side. It took them an hour to make the travoy. Tom found a couple of fairly straight sticks to ram down into the sleeping bag and out the holes at the bottom. Tom got some rope from the U-Haul where he had gotten the broiling pan, and Stu used it to secure the sleeping bag to the poles. When it was done, it reminded Stu more of a crazy rickshaw than a travoy like the ones the Plains Indians had used. Tom picked up the poles and looked doubtfully over his shoulder.
Are you in, Stu?
Yeah.
He wondered how long the seams would hold before unraveling straight up the sides of the bag.
How heavy am I, Tommy?
Not bad. I can haul you a long way. Get up!
They started moving. The gully where Stu had broken his leg, where he had been sure he was going to die, fell slowly behind them. Weak though he was, Stu felt a mad sort of exultation. Not there, anyway. He was going to die somewhere, and probably soon, but it wasn't going to be alone in that muddy ditch. The sleeping bag swayed back and forth, lulling him. He dozed. Tom pulled him along under a thickening scud of clouds. Kojak padded along beside them. Stu woke up when Tom eased him down.
Sorry, Tom said apologetically. I had to rest my arms.
He first twirled, then flexed them.
You rest all you want, Stu said. Slow and easy wins the race.
His head was thudding. He found the anison and dry-swallowed two of them. It felt as if his throat had been lined with sandpaper and some sadistic soul was striking matches on it. He checked the sleeping bag seams. As he had expected, they were coming unraveled, but it wasn't too bad yet. They were on a long, gradual upslope, exactly the sort of thing he had been looking for. On a slope like this, better than 2 miles long, a car with the clutch disengaged could get cruising along pretty good. You could try to pop-start it in second, maybe even third gear. He looked longingly to the left, where a plum-colored Triumph was parked askew in the breakdown lane. Something skeletal in a bright woolen sweater leaned behind the wheel. The Triumph would have a manual transmission, but there was no way in God's world that he could get his splinted leg into that small cabin. "How far have we come?" he asked Tom, but Tom could only shrug. It had been quite a piece, anyway, Stu thought. Tom had pulled him for at least 3 hours before stopping to rest. It spoke of phenomenal strength. The old landmarks were gone in the distance. Tom, who was built like a young bull, had dragged him maybe 6 or 8 miles while he dozed. "You rest all you want," he repeated. "Don't knock yourself out." "Tom's okay. O and K, that spells okay, laws, yes, everybody knows that." Tom wolfed a huge lunch, and Stu managed to eat a little. Then they went on. The road continued to curve upward, and Stu began to realize it had to be this hill. If they crested it without finding the right car, it would take them another 2 hours to get to the next one. Then dark. Rain or snow, from the look of the sky. A nice cold night out in the wet. And goodbye, Stu Redman. They came up to a Chevrolet sedan. "Stop," he croaked, and Tom set the travoy down. "Go over and look in that car. Count the pedals on the floor. Tell me if there's 2 or 3. Tom trotted over and opened the car door. A mummy in a flowered print dress fell out like someone's bad joke. Her purse fell out beside her, scattering cosmetics, tissues, and money. 2, Tom called back to Stu. "Okay, we gotta go on." Tom came back, took a deep breath, and grabbed the handles of the travoy. A quarter of a mile farther along, they came to a VW van. "Want me to count the pedals?" Tom asked. "No, not this time." The van was standing on 3 flats. He began to think they were not going to find it. Their luck was simply not in. They came to a station wagon that had only 1 flat shoe. It could be changed, but like the Chevy sedan, Tom reported it only had 2 pedals. That meant it was an automatic, and that meant it was useless to them. They pushed on. The long hill was flattening out now, beginning to crest. Stu could see 1 more car ahead, 1 last chance. Stu's heart sank. It was a very old Plymouth, a 1970 at best. For a wonder, it was standing on 4 inflated tires, but it was rust-eaten and battered. Nobody had ever bothered with much in the way of maintenance on this heap. Stu knew its sort well enough from Arnett. The battery would be old and probably cracked, the oil would be blacker than midnight in a mine shaft, but there would be a pink fuzz runner around the steering wheel and maybe a stuffed poodle with rhinestone eyes and a knotty head on the back shelf. "Want me to check?" Tom asked. "Yeah, I guess so. Beggars can't be choosers, can they?" A fine cold mist was starting to drift down from the sky. Tom crossed the road and looked inside the car, which was empty. Stu lay shivering inside the sleeping bag. At last Tom came back. 3 pedals, he said. Stu tried to think it out. That high, sweet-sour buzzing in his head kept trying to get in the way. The old Plymouth was almost surely a loser. They could go on over to the other side of the hill, but then all the cars would be pointing the wrong way, uphill, unless they crossed the median strip, which was a rocky half-mile wide here. Maybe they could manage to find a standard shift car on the other side, but by then it would be dark.
"Tom, help me get up."
Somehow, Tom helped him to his foot without hurting his broken leg too badly. His head thumped and buzzed. Black comets shot across his field of vision, and he nearly passed out. Then he had 1 arm around Tom's neck.
"Rest," he muttered. "Rest."
He had no idea how long they stood that way, Tom supporting him patiently as he swam around in the gray half-tones of semi-consciousness. When the world finally came back, Tom was still patiently supporting him. The mist had thickened to a slow, cold drizzle.
"Tom, help me across to it."
Tom put an arm around Stu's waist, and the two of them staggered across to where the old Plymouth stood in the breakdown lane.
"Hood release," Stu muttered, fumbling in the Plymouth's grill.
Sweat rolled down his face. Shudders racked him. He found the hood release but couldn't pull it up. He guided Tom's hands to it, and at last the hood swung up. The engine was about what Stu had expected, a dirty and indifferently maintained V8, but the battery wasn't as bad as he had feared it would be. It was a Sears, not the top of the line, but the guarantee punch was February of 1991. Struggling against the feverish rush of his thoughts, Stu counted backward and guessed that the battery had been new last May.
"Go try the horn," he told Tom, and propped himself against the car while Tom leaned in to do it.
He had heard of drowning men grasping at straws, and he guessed that now he understood. His last chance of surviving this was a rattletrap junkyard refugee. The horn gave a loud honk. Okay, then. If there was a key, take the shot. Probably he should have had Tom check that first, but on second thought it didn't much matter. If there was no key, they were most likely all through, no matter what. He got the hood down and latched by leaning all of his weight on it. Then he hopped around to the driver's door and stared in, fully expecting to see an empty ignition slot. But the keys were there, dangling from an imitation leather case with the initials AC on it. Bending in carefully, he turned the key over to accessory. Slowly, the gas gauge needle swung over to a little more than a quarter of a tank. Here was a mystery. Why had the car's owner, why had AC pulled over to walk when he could have driven? In his lightheaded state, Stu thought of Charles Campion, almost dead, driving into Hap's pumps. Old AC had the superflu, had it bad, final stages. He pulls over, shuts off his car's engine, not because he's thinking about it, but because it's a long-ingrained habit, and gets out. He's delirious, maybe hallucinating. He stumbles out into the Utah Badlands, laughing and singing and muttering and cackling, and dies there. 4 months later, Stu Redman and Tom Cullen happen along, and the keys are in the car, and the battery's relatively fresh, and there's gas. The hand of God. Wasn't that what Tom had said about Vegas? The hand of God came down out of the sky. And maybe God had left this battered 70 Plymouth here for them, like manna in the desert. It was a crazy idea, but no more crazy than the idea of a 100-year-old black woman leading a bunch of refugees into the promised land. "And she still made her own biscuits," he croaked. "Right up until the very end, she still made her own biscuits." "What, Stu?" "Never mind. Move over, Tom." Tom did. "Can we ride?" he asked hopefully. Stu pushed the driver's seat down so Kojak could hop in, which he did after a careful sniff or two. "I don't know. You just better pray this thing starts." "Okay," Tom said agreeably. It took Stu 5 minutes just to get behind the wheel. He sat on a slant, almost in the place where a middle front seat passenger was supposed to sit. Kojak sat attentively in the back seat, panting. The car was littered with McDonald's boxes and Taco Bell wrappers. The interior smelled like an old corn chip. Stu turned the key. The old Plymouth cranked briskly for about 20 seconds, and then the starter began to lag. Stu tapped the horn again, and this time there was only a feeble croak. Tom's face fell. "We're not done with her yet," Stu said. He was encouraged. There was juice lurking inside that Sears battery yet. He pushed in the clutch and shifted up to second. "Open your door and get us rolling, then hop back in." Tom said doubtfully, "Isn't the car pointing the wrong way?" "Right now it is, but if we can get this old shit heap running, we'll fix that in a hurry." Tom got out and started pushing on the doorpost. The Plymouth began to roll.
When the speedometer got up to 5 miles per hour, Stu said, "Hop in, Tom." Tom got in and slammed his door. Stu turned the ignition key to the on position and waited. The steering was power, no good with the engine off, and it took most of his fading strength just to keep the nose of the Plymouth pointed straight down the road. The speedometer needle crawled up to 10, 15, 20. They were rolling silently down the hill Tom had spent most of the morning dragging them up. Dew collected on the windshield. Too late, Stu realized they had left the travoy behind. 25 miles per hour now.
"It's not running, Stu," Tom said anxiously.
30 miles per hour. High enough.
"God help us now," Stu said, and popped the clutch.
The Plymouth bucked and jerked. The engine coughed into life, spluttered, missed, stalled. Stu groaned, as much with frustration as with the bolt of pain that shot up his shattered leg.
"Shit fire," he cried, and depressed the clutch again.
"Pump that gas pedal, Tom. Use your hand."
"Which one is it?" Tom cried anxiously.
"It's the long one." Tom got down on the floor and pumped the gas pedal twice. The car was picking up speed again, and Stu had to force himself to wait. They were better than halfway down the slope.
"Now,"
he shouted, and popped the clutch again. The Plymouth roared into life. Kojak barked. Black smoke boiled out of the rusty exhaust pipe and turned blue. Then the car was running, choppily, missing on 2 cylinders, but really running. Stu snap-shifted to 3rd and popped the clutch again, running all the pedals with his left foot.
"We're going, Tom," he bellowed. "We got us some wheels now."
Tom shouted with pleasure. Kojak barked and wagged his tail. In his previous life, the life before Captain Trips, when he had been Big Steve, he had ridden often in his master's car. It was nice to be riding again with his new masters. They came to a U-turn road between the westbound and eastbound lanes about 4 miles down the road. "Official vehicles only," a stern sign warned. Stu managed to manipulate the clutch well enough to get them around and into the eastbound lanes, having only one bad moment when the old car hitched and bucked and threatened to stall. But the engine was warm now, and he eased them through. He got back up to 3rd gear and then relaxed a little, breathing hard, trying to catch up with his heartbeat, which was fast and thready. The grayness wanted to come back in and swamp him, but he wouldn't let it. A few minutes later, Tom spotted the bright orange sleeping bag that had been Stu's makeshift travoy.
"Bye-bye," Tom called in high good humor. "Bye-bye, we're going to Boulder, laws yes."
"I'll be content with Green River tonight," Stu thought. They got there just after dark, Stu moving the Plymouth carefully in low gear through the dark streets, which were dotted with abandoned cars. He parked on the main drag in front of a building that announced itself as the Utah Hotel. It was a dismal frame building 3 stories high, and Stu didn't think the Waldorf Astoria had anything to worry about in the way of competition just yet. His head was jangling again, and he was flickering in and out of reality. The car had seemed stuffed with people at times during the last 20 miles. Fran, Nick Andrews, Norm Bruette. He had looked over once, and it had seemed that Chris Ortega, the bartender at the Indian Head, was riding shotgun. Tired. Had he ever been so tired?
"In there," he muttered. "We gotta stay the night, Nicky. I'm done up."
"It's Tom, Stu. Tom Cullen, laws, yes."
"Tom, yeah. We gotta stop. Can you help me in?"
"Sure. Getting this old car to run, that was great."
"I'll have another beer," Stu told him. "And ain't you got a cigarette? I'm dying for a smoke."
He fell forward over the wheel. Tom got out and carried him into the hotel. The lobby was damp and dark, but there was a fireplace and a half-filled wood box beside it. Tom set Stu down on a threadbare sofa below a great stuffed moose head, and then set about building a fire while Kojak padded around, sniffing at things. Stu's breath came slow and raspy. He muttered occasionally, and every now and then he would scream something unintelligible,
freezing Tom's blood. He kindled a monster blaze and then went looking around. He found pillows and blankets for himself and Stu. He pushed the sofa Stu was on a little closer to the fire, and then Tom bedded down next to him. Kojak lay on the other side, so that they bracketed the sick man with their heat. Tom lay looking at the ceiling, which was scrolled tin and laced with cobwebs at the corners. Stu was very sick. It was a worrisome thing. If he woke up again, Tom would ask him what to do about the sickness. But suppose he didn't wake up. Outside, the wind had picked up and went howling past the hotel. Rain lashed at the windows. By midnight, after Tom had gone to sleep, the temperature had dropped another 4 degrees, and the sound turned to the gritty slap of sleet. Far away to the west, the storm's outer edges were urging a vast cloud of radioactive pollution toward California, where more would die. At some time after 2 in the morning, Kojak raised his head and whined uneasily. Tom Cullen was getting up. His eyes were wide and blank. Kojak whined again, but Tom took no notice of him. He went to the door and let himself out into the screaming night. Kojak went to the hotel lobby window and put his paws up, looking out. He looked for some time, making low and unhappy sounds in his throat. Then he went back and laid down next to Stu again. Outside, the wind howled and screeched. Chapter 75. I almost died, you know, Nick said. He and Tom were walking up the empty sidewalk together. The wind howled steadily, an endless ghost train highballing through the black sky. It made odd, low hooting noises in the alleyways. Hants, Tom would have said awake, and run away. But he wasn't awake, not exactly, and Nick was with him. Sleet smacked coldly against his cheeks. "You did?" Tom asked. "My laws." Nick laughed. His voice was low and musical, a good voice. Tom loved to listen to him talk. "I sure did. That's a big laws, yes. The flu didn't get me, but a little scratch along the leg almost did. Here, look at this." Seemingly oblivious of the cold, Nick unbuckled his jeans and pushed them down. Tom bent forward curiously, no different from any small boy who has been offered a glimpse of a wart with hair growing out of it, or an interesting wound or puncture. Running down Nick's leg was an ugly scar, barely healed. It started just below the groin, in the slab part of the thigh, and corkscrewed past the knee to mid-shin, where it finally petered out.
"And that almost killed you?"
Nick pulled up his jeans and belted them.
"It wasn't deep, but it got infected. Infection means that the bad germs got into it. Infection's the most dangerous thing there is, Tom. Infection was what made the superflu germ kill all the people. And infection is what made people want to make the germ in the first place. An infection of the mind."
"Infection," Tom whispered, fascinated. They were walking again, almost floating along the sidewalk.
"Tom, Stu's got an infection now."
"No.
No, don't say that, Nick. You're scaring Tom Cullen. Laws, yes, you are."
"I know I am, Tom, and I'm sorry. But you have to know. He has pneumonia in both lungs. He's been sleeping outside for nearly 2 weeks. There are things you have to do for him. And still, he'll almost certainly die. You have to be prepared for that."
"No, don't, Tom."
Nick put his hand on Tom's shoulder, but Tom felt nothing. It was as if Nick's hand was nothing but smoke.
"If he dies, you and Kojak have to go on. You have to get back to Boulder and tell them that you saw the hand of God in the desert. If it's God's will, Stu will go with you, in time. If it's God's will that Stu should die, then he will, like me."
"Nick," Tom begged. "Please, I showed you my leg for a reason. There are pills for infections, in places like this."
Tom looked around and was surprised to see that they were no longer on the street. They were in a dark store, a drug store,
A wheelchair was suspended on piano wire from the ceiling like a ghostly mechanical corpse. A sign on Tom's right advertised Continence Supplies.
"Yes, sir, may I help you?"
Tom whirled around. Nick was behind the counter in a white coat.
"Nick?"
"Yes, sir."
Nick began to put small bottles of pills in front of Tom.
"This is penicillin. Very good for pneumonia. This is ampicillin, and this one's amoxicillin. Also good stuff. And this is V-cillin, most commonly given to children, and it may work if the others don't. He's to drink lots of water, and he should have juices, but that may not be possible. So give him these. They're vitamin C tablets. Also, he must be walked."
"I can't remember all of that,"
Tom wailed.
"I'm afraid you'll have to, because there is no one else. You're on your own."
Tom began to cry. Nick leaned forward. His arm swung. There was no slap. Again, there was only that feeling that Nick was smoke which had passed around him and possibly through him. But Tom felt his head rock back all the same. Something in his head seemed to snap.
"Stop that. You can't be a baby now, Tom. Be a man. For God's sake, be a man."
Tom stared at Nick, his hand on his cheek, his eyes wide.
"Walk him," Nick said. "Get him on his good leg. Drag him if you have to, but get him off his back or he'll drown."
"He isn't himself," Tom said. "He shouts. He shouts to people who aren't there."
"He's delirious. Walk him anyway, all you can. Make him take the penicillin, one pill at a time. Give him aspirin. Keep him warm. Pray. Those are all the things you can do."
"All right, Nick. All right, I'll try to be a man. I'll try to remember. But I wish you was here. Laws, yes, I do."
"You do your best, Tom. That's all."
Nick was gone. Tom woke up and found himself standing in the deserted drugstore by the prescription counter. Standing on the glass were four bottles of pills. Tom stared at them for a long time, and then gathered them up. Tom came back at 4 in the morning, his shoulders frosted with sleet. Outside it was letting up, and there was a thin, clean line of dawn in the east. Kojak barked an ecstatic welcome, and Stu moaned and woke up. Tom knelt beside him.
"Stu?"
"Tom?"
"Hard to breathe." "I've got medicine, Stu. Nick showed me. You take it and get rid of that infection. You have to take one right now."
From the bag he had brought in, Tom produced the four bottles of pills and a tall bottle of Gatorade. Nick had been wrong about the juice. There was plenty of bottled juice in the Green River Superette. Stu looked at the pills, holding them closely to his eyes.
"Tom, where did you get these?"
"In the drugstore. Nick gave them to me."
"No, really."
"Really, really. You have to take the penicillin first to see if that works. Which one says penicillin?"
"This one does. But, Tom..."
"No, you have to. Nick said so. And you have to walk."
"I can't walk. I got a bust leg. And I'm sick."
Stu's voice became sulky, petulant. It was a sick room voice.
"You have to, or I'll drag you," Tom said.
Stu lost his tenuous grip on reality. Tom put one of the penicillin capsules in his mouth, and Stu reflex swallowed it with Gatorade to keep from choking. He began to cough wretchedly anyway, and Tom pounded him on the back as if he were burping a baby. Then he hauled Stu to his good foot by main force and began to drag him around the lobby, Kojak following them anxiously.
"Please, God," Tom said. "Please, God, please, God."
Stu cried out,
"I know where I can get her a washboard, Glenn. That music store has 'em. I seen one in the window." "Please, God," Tom panted.
Stu's head lolled on his shoulder. It felt as hot as a furnace. His splinted leg dragged uselessly. Boulder had never seemed so far away as it did on that dismal morning. Stu's struggle with pneumonia lasted 2 weeks. He drank quarts of Gatorade, V8, Welch's grape juice, and various brands of orange drink. He rarely knew what he was drinking. His urine was strong and acidic.
He messed himself like a baby, and like a baby's, his stools were yellow and loose and totally blameless. Tom kept him clean. Tom dragged him around the lobby of the Utah Hotel, and Tom waited for the night when he would wake